And if you're just tuning in, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. If you're a fan of the HBO series Game of Thrones, which begins again tomorrow, you may also like dragons, which feature prominently in the series. And it just so happens that dragons are also featured in two new movies, a new book, new video games, and a museum exhibit. Why now? NPR's Allison Keyes investigates.
In many Asian cultures, this is the year of the dragon. At Washington, D.C.'s parade marking the auspicious occasion, Jalen Ahmad was among the grinning people standing along the route, watching the multi-hued dragons prance sinuously down the street. He says the year of the dragon is exciting and significant in the Chinese zodiac.
I feel like for the dragon, it's very powerful, strong, courageous.
6-year-old Makora Dubos, here with her mom, likes dragons for their looks, not their brains.
Do you think they're pretty?
Yes.
Do you think they're smart?
No.
But Makora, they are cunning. That must be how they've wormed their way so deeply into our hearts.
Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea.
From Peter, Paul, and Mary's friendly, playful dragon. To the terrifying dragons in the top-selling video game, The Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, to Game of Thrones, where three baby dragons are about to cause all sorts of drama.
When my dragons are grown, we will take back what was stolen from me and destroy those who have wronged me.
None of us can choose our destiny, Merlin.
Then there's Kilgara, the sly dragon who was both friend and sometime foe to King Arthur's protector Merlin in the BBC TV series.
And none of us can escape it.
I thought it'd be quite fun to play a dragon.
Actor John Hurt just received two British Lifetime Achievement Awards and plays the great dragon on the show. He says Kilgara is an interesting character who just happens to be a dragon. And that dragon cares for both Merlin and Camelot.
Cares about the country, you know, he cares in his own way. But, I mean, he is a dragon, so therefore you can't be completely relied upon.
Hurt echoes scholars who believe one of the reasons dragons permeate cultures around the world is because fossils that somewhat resemble dragons have been found all over the planet, some before there had been any study of paleontology.
His very early findings of dinosaurs and so on. And I think that's where the mythology of the dragon came from.
For thousands of years, people around the world have told stories of these mythical creatures with supernatural powers.
Lee Talbot is a curator at the Textile Museum in Washington, D.C. The museum is currently running an exhibition called Dragons, Nagas, and Creatures of the Deep. The oldest piece in it is a tunic panel from 5th century Egypt featuring an ancestor of the modern dragon.
Technically, the name of the creature is a hippocamp, and it is a cross between a horse and a fish.
Talbot says at the same time, on the other side of the world in China, there was a legend about a dragon that was also a cross between a fish and a horse. He points at an elaborate navy blue gauze jacket from early 18th century China, adorned with fearsome-looking golden dragons with open mouths and outstretched claws.
Only the Emperor of China, his wife, and immediate family were allowed to wear 5 clawed dragons.
In East Asia, dragons are symbols of power and protection and are closely related to water and rainfall. But in Europe, dragons are seen as dangerous. The curator says they're worse than that in the Christian tradition.
The stories of, for example, St. George and the dragon. The dragon started to symbolize evil and Satan, and then the saint symbolizing Christianity, battling paganism.
But that just covers the dragons on this planet. The extraterrestrial dragons in author Todd McCaffrey's world are beyond friendly. He says these dragons, from the iconic Dragon Riders of Pern series, bond telepathically with their riders.
You really didn't want something that big and that powerful not united with a human in a way that would allow us to survive.
By big, McCaffrey means the size of a wide-bodied jet plane. Pern's dragons have head knobs like giraffes, multifaceted eyes, and skin rather like the hide of a horse. But McCaffrey says he thinks the reason people are so fascinated by dragons goes way beyond their looks.
I think dragons are a really fundamental embodiment of our wishes and dreams.
On top of that, McCaffrey says they're incredibly powerful, and they embody the best of humans and their aspirations.
Dragons are sort of like the love of dinosaurs that little kids have, but now they can fly. And they breathe fire, too. How much better can it get?
Allison Keyes, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley.
Two cable TV series that drew a lot of attention during their first seasons are back Sunday night to start a second year. One hoping to build on the momentum from some positive late-season buzz, the other hoping to overcome some negative buzz from last year's cliffhanger. AMC's The Killing started strong, with raves from critics and an impressively loyal core of viewers. But in the final episode of the year, when it left its season-long murder mystery intentionally unresolved, most fans felt angry, even betrayed. HBO's Game of Thrones, on the other hand, took a bit longer to get established and to get as much attention. But thanks to some strong performances and a few bold strokes of plot, Game of Thrones, based on the popular George R.R. Martin fantasy novels of neighboring kingdoms at war, kept building in intensity and in viewership all the way to the season finale. That finale ended with the fiery birth of a dragon, but by then, that was the only part of Game of Thrones that was dragon. The Killing, on the other hand, seemed to almost limp to the end of season one, spending entire episodes on red herrings or subplot detours. But now, Sunday night on their respective networks, these two shows return, and they both revert to old habits. The Killing, in other words, starts strong again. The central question from last year, who killed Rosie Larson, quickly comes back into play. And with it, there are new leads, new confrontations, even some new characters introduced. However, AMC has requested an embargo of so many plot points that there's virtually no scene I can play without revealing too much about the fate of the show's characters and investigation. So I'll play along, which means I won't play a clip. What I will say, though, is by the time the two-hour premiere is over, we learn a lot, and many questions indeed are answered. But with some of the answers come some new questions, such as, why didn't this clue or this witness surface before? Does this person's behavior really make sense? And finally, is it really worth caring about these characters all over again? My answer to that last question is yes, but you'll have to answer that one for yourself. Whether to commit to these ongoing complicated narrative TV series, and when, and for how long, is a very subjective choice. For example, it took me about 5 episodes last season to get fully into Game of Thrones. That's when Peter Dinklage, as a formidable member of the Lannister clan, finally won me over. And I wasn't alone. Later that year, he won an Emmy. By the time season one was over, there were a handful of characters who entertained me consistently, and most of them, though not all, even managed to survive to show up again for season two. There's Dinklage, of course, who returns to the Lannister kingdom more influential than ever, thanks to a scroll that gives him power by proxy. He reveals that scroll, and his new role, by barging into a high council session presided over by his power-hungry sister, played by Lena Headey. It's just the latest move in their very high-stakes game of sibling rivalry.
What are you doing here? This is the small council.
Yes, well, I do believe the Hand of the King is welcome at all small council meetings.
Our father is Hand of the King.
Yes, but in his absence...
Your father has named Lord Tyrion to serve as Hand in his stead while he fights...
Out! All of you, out! I would like to know how you tricked Father into this.
If I were capable of tricking Father, I'd be Emperor of the World by now. You brought this on yourself.
I've done nothing.
Quite right. You did nothing. When your son called for Ned Stark's head. Now the entire North has risen up against us.
I tried to stop it.
Did you? You failed. That bit of theater will haunt our family for a generation.
Robb Stark is a child.
Who's won every battle he's fought? Do you understand we're losing the war?
What do you know about warfare?
Nothing. But I know people, and I know that our enemies hate each other almost as much as they hate us.
Season 2 of Game of Thrones gets more expansive, even literally. It covers more ground, roams new corners of the kingdom, even introduces new characters. But the old habit to which Game of Thrones reverts is an overly patient fascination with its own world and all the people in it. Once again, at spots, I found myself not knowing who certain characters were, and not caring, especially when central stories were sidelined. But both these series, in their second seasons, are heading somewhere. The Killing will solve its mystery. And Game of Thrones, before this season is out, will go to war. As a TV viewer who's already watching too many novelistic shows each week, I say let it happen quickly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Snow White didn't play much basketball, but she's also having a moment. The new movie Mirror Mirror stars Julia Roberts as the Evil Queen, and in June, another Snow White movie opens starring another Oscar winner, Charlize Theron, in the exact same role. Disney's working on a new film loosely based on Snow White, set in 19th century China. And Pierre's Netta Ulaby wondered what makes Snow White so right for right now.
Once upon a time, it was Cinderella who was Hollywood's hottest starlet. The Cinderella story was cinematic catnip. Princess Diaries, Ever After, 2 Weeks Notice, Ella Enchanted, Made in Manhattan, and yes, yes, obviously.
Pretty woman, walking down the street, pretty woman.
But there's a new ingenue in town. She's fresh, she's frosty, and her image hasn't changed much since Walt Disney set the Snow White standard in 1939.
Someday, my prince will come.
Snow White is, of course, the story of a poor girl whose beauty earns her the envy of an evil queen. She's poisoned, put in a coma, but she prevails thanks to a prince and 7 short men.
Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from Earth we go.
After decades of the cold shoulder, why is Snow White suddenly white hot? Maria Tatar is a Harvard professor with an expertise in fairy tales.
It may be that there is something about the boomer anxiety about aging that is renewing our interest in Snow White.
To age my voice, an old hag's cackle.
In the Disney film, there's that terrible moment, that terrifying moment when the wicked queen drinks the potion, turns into an old hag, and we see the aging process.
The new Snow White movie, Mirror, Mirror, is also meant for families with little kids. But screenwriter Melissa Wallach wanted to make the story contemporary. Part of that meant acknowledging baby boomers' grandparents' concerns about aging.
What is interesting now is almost the first time really in history that you can remain young. I mean, everyone is out there shooting themselves with Botox.
The treatment is ready.
In the movie, Julia Roberts gets an Evil Queen spa special with scorpion bites, bee stings, bird poop, and grubs sticking around in her ears.
Oh, it's always the worst part.
Wallach says every time she opens a magazine or turns on the television, she sees actors like Angelina Jolie looking as young as they did decades ago. That was not the case for stars of an earlier generation, Elizabeth Taylor, Lauren Bacall, or Katharine Hepburn. Wallach says ours is an age where chemical peels and other enhancements are pitched to almost everyone.
You can kind of stay in this state of youth forever.
The second Snow White movie coming out this summer is darker, much more high-tech, violent, and visually sumptuous.
Beauty is my power.
It stars Twilight's Kristen Stewart and Charlize Theron as the Evil Queen.
Mirror. Mirror on the wall. Who is fairest of them all?
You are the fairest, but there is another destined to surpass you.
It's that tension, says Harvard professor Maria Tatar, that might also help explain Snow White's recent revival.
Maybe it's the mother-daughter rivalry that has caught our attention, with so many women trying to remain youthful now.
You can even see that, says Tatar, on a reality show fairy tale like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, filled with beautiful princesses, sham weddings, and, like Snow White, an older versus younger woman dynamic.
The mother is constantly competing with her daughters for attention. And she's got these gorgeous daughters, so she becomes more anxious than ever about aging.
I'm going through menopause, and I have all these weird issues, and my bladder leaks. This is like an old person's problem.
I feel like it really sucks to get old, and sometimes I feel betrayed by my own body. Hello.
Fairy tales are a way to explore such elemental human concerns, says Tatar. What fascinates her is which ones bubble up and why. Right now, it's not just Snow White, she says. There's also a bunch of Sleeping Beauties in the works.
So why Snow White at this time? Why the catatonic girl, as in Sleeping Beauty?
Maybe it's some sort of backlash, Tatar says, about women now outnumbering men in college or outpacing them at work. Or maybe it's not. Maybe there's a female fantasy about how great it would be to get to sleep undisturbed for a couple thousand years. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.